Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I think it's safe to say that one of the most unique filmmakers working today is Wes Anderson. He's the writer and director of 11 feature films and several more short films. All of them feature his diorama-esque style, charming music, and unforgettable characters. One of our favorite movie and TV critics here at Beta is Matt Zoller-Seitz. Matt was one of the first critics to discover Wes's talent back when they were both in Texas. And he's put together companion books for several of Wes's films. He joins us now to talk about his book on Wes's New Yorker homage, The French Dispatch. The book features sumptuous color photos throughout, and Matt's beautiful prose. I think Matt has put almost as much work into this book as Wes puts into his enchanting, one-of-a-kind films. We talked to Matt about how Wes puts his films together, their friendship, and why Wes wanted to do a movie about The New Yorker.
I've been friends with Wes for, God, over 30 years now. And I was a young critic in Dallas when he was making his short film, Bottle Rocket. And he told me I was the first person ever to review a movie of his. And I've gotten to watch him evolve over that span of time, professionally and personally. But I do know that he always loved The New Yorker from the time he was in high school. And I think he got his subscription in college, and he has every issue of The New Yorker that he ever received in leather-bound editions in his New York offices. So he was always interested in The New Yorker, but he didn't start to get interested in the history of The New Yorker until I told him about this book by a New Yorker contributor called Joseph Mitchell.
Yeah.
The title was Up in the Old Hotel, and this was published in the 90s, and it was kind of this incredible breakout thing that introduced the writing of Mitchell to a wide audience that didn't even know his name. And that was what got him into the history of The New Yorker, and I think his research into the history of The New Yorker and all the books and articles that have been written about The New Yorker and contributors and editors of The New Yorker, I think that's what ultimately led to The French Dispatch.
Mm-hmm. And Joseph Mitchell's work is great. I love his work. I think I've read almost everything he's written, and he's really a great writer.
Well, the character of Herb St. Sazerac, who's the Owen Wilson character, the American abroad, is kind of a model on a few New Yorker writers, but he's mostly Mitchell. And Mitchell was what was called a pure reporter, which is a concept that I always admired and I've had very few chances to emulate. And a pure reporter is somebody who doesn't get assigned a story and isn't driven by the news cycle, but instead will simply just go about the world looking for interesting things to write about.
Like every living city, Ennui supports a menagerie of vermin and scavengers.
The rats which colonized its subterranean railroad, the cats which colonized its slanty rooftops, the anguillette which colonized its shallow drainage canals.
Joseph Mitchell did those kinds of stories. Like, he did an entire feature about the rat problem on the waterfront, and he did a story about a West Village eccentric named Joe Gould, which was the subject of a piece called Joe Gould's Secret. And then you've also got James Baldwin, who's kind of represented by the Jeffrey Wright character in the third quote-unquote feature article segment of the film, and the one with the kidnapping of the chef, played by Stephen Park. And there's a lot of other New Yorker writers who are represented in there as well. And it's an amalgam. I mean, it's never just one person. It's like he's putting bits and pieces of two or three different people together, usually.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Wes was really hell-bent on making a movie in France for his entire career. Why?
From a very early age, he was obsessed with all things French. And I remember when I saw Bottle Rocket, the short film, for the first time, one of the things that jumped out at me was he had a shot-for-shot homage to a scene in The 400 Blows, the Truffaut's debut film. And the movie, the Bottle Rocket, the short, was in black and white, 16 millimeter, and the cutting and the compositions and the whole flavor of it with the jazz music was very French New Wave. And I remember thinking, oh my God, he made Dallas, which, among other things, is not known for its architecturally dazzling qualities, look like it could be France in the 50s. I've never seen Dallas look cooler on film than it did in that short. And that was the French influence. You know, he's loved Paris ever since he visited it. He loves France. He's traveled around France via rail a lot. And he's kind of a citizen of the world now. He rarely spends more than 6 months in one place.
Would you consider The French Dispatch a French film?
No, I wouldn't. In the same way that I wouldn't consider Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon to be an American film or a Chinese film. It's a kind of a hybrid, if that makes any sense. Like, you know, the French, as far as I understand, at least respect and in many cases have embraced the French Dispatch. And Olivia Picel, who is one of the producers of the film, holds dual French and American citizenship. And she was talking to me about how when French people watch the French Dispatch, what they're seeing reflected back at them is a kind of an American version of France, like a sort of an idealized, almost mythological version of France. And even though it's not true, they appreciate it, probably in the same way that Americans appreciated the version of the American West that the Italian filmmaker Sergio Leone presented to them in his spaghetti westerns. Like, we looked at it, we knew that this was not anything like what the American West was actually was. It was some almost more like something out of science fiction. It was just deranged. And yet we understood the archetypes and we liked the excitement. We liked the interest. We were flattered by the attention. And I think that's probably what she was getting at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. French filmmaker Nicolas Sada says that West views the world as one huge dysfunctional family and that all of his movies in one way or another are about family. Is that true of the French Dispatch?
I think it's absolutely true of the French Dispatch, and it's true of all of his movies to greater or lesser degrees. And the French Dispatch family is a family of writers, editors, fact checkers, and other people who work at the magazine. And it's about the idea of creating a family, sort of Frankensteining together this patchwork new family in lieu of or in place of the one that you were born into.
Arthur Howitzer Jr., born in North Kansas, 10 miles from the geographical center of the United States.
Mother died when he was 5.
Son of a newspaper publisher, founder of this magazine.
The French Dispatch, previously known as Picnic.
A largely unread Sunday supplement to the Liberty, Kansas Evening Sun.
It began as a holiday.
Is that true?
Sort of.
That's been a theme of his, since Rushmore, where, you know, the theater is kind of the idealized family that the hero really needs, but more so in The Royal Tenenbaums, which is, about struggling to reconcile the family you're born into and the family that you really would like to have and or be a part of. And then The Life Aquatic, it's all the guys on the boat. And, he does sort of juxtapose those two things, the blood family and the created family.
Interesting. I want to ask you about Wes's writing process. Does he come to these movies with the story all set?
No, not at all. And that's another thing that's been really almost revelatory for me. Wes has always been known as being a controlling, precise, methodical filmmaker. And that is very, very true when it comes to the production part of it and the post-production part of it. But the writing part of it is as open and intuitive as anybody's. What he will have is he doesn't come in with the entire story and all the characters all mapped out in his brain. He needs other people to create the story with him. And he does the story conference thing where it'll be himself and a kind of a rotating group of collaborators. There might be one person, there might be two, there might be three people in the room with him, but they will start with an idea for a scene or a story or a sequence, and then they will work their way through it, and then they will say, well, what happens next?
What are you writing?
Our manifesto. Then you should study our resolutions. Or anyway, will you proofread it? My parents think you're a good writer.
Give it to me.
It's a little damp.
Physically or metaphorically?
Both, based on the cover and the first four sentences.
Don't criticize my manifesto.
Oh, you don't want remarks?
I don't need remarks, do I? I only asked you to proofread it because I thought you'd be even more impressed by how good it already is.
Let's start with the typos.
When he works on the story, he works with people like Jason Schwartzman, who's also obviously one of his major actors, and Hugo Guinness, who collaborated on the story for The French Dispatch, and Roman Coppola, who's his second unit director, co-producer, and very close friend for a long time. Schwartzman described it to me as being almost like a detective story. And Wes will be like Columbo. He'll be asking questions of people. And they're never leading questions. They're always very open questions like, what, you know, where does he go after that? What is she thinking as she says this? Things like that.
Right. And does Wes ever channel his inner Peter Falk? He mentioned Columbo and, like, you know, he starts to leave and then turns around and says, just one more thing. I wonder if he ever does that. Probably not. Yeah. So there are three main stories or articles and one talk of the town like prologue. If we cut these into four short films and said you could only watch one of them, which would it be and why?
Oh, my gosh. That's a tough one. Well, I will say that the sequence with the student protesters and the French Dispatch writer who's trying to sort of make sense of them for an American audience, that's the one that's become the hardest for me to watch. And in fact, I've watched the film probably 8 or 9 or 10 times. I don't even remember how many times. But towards the end, I got to the point where I started to skip the last 5 minutes of that one because it was too painful for me.
His parents will receive a telephone call at midnight, dress briskly, mechanically, and hold hands in the silent taxi as they go to identify the body of their cold son. His likeness, mass-produced and shrink-wrap packaged, will be sold like bubblegum to the hero-inspired who hope to see themselves like this. The touching narcissism of the young.
I think that's probably altogether the most powerful one for me. Not the one, I hesitate to call it my favorite because it's emotionally a lot. But I like all three of the feature stories equally and for different reasons. I think the Benicio del Toro one, where he plays the painter, is a really rich exploration of the creative process and the relationship between money and art.
It's not for sale.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
It is. Yes, it is. All artists sell all their work. It's what makes you an artist, selling it. If you don't wish to sell it, don't paint it. Question is, what's your price?
50 cigarettes. Actually, make it 75.
And I think the final one with Jeffrey Wright as the reporter trying to profile the personal chef of the police chief of Ennui, played by Stephen Park, is a great just caper comedy. And it's also a really nice meditation on what it means to be a foreigner or an immigrant or a stranger in a strange land. And that's kind of what both of those guys are. And there's the moment at the end where the two of them speak to each other and kind of acknowledge each other's fundamental connectedness is, I think, one of the most touching scenes in any of his films.
I'm a foreigner, you know.
The city's full of us, isn't it? I'm one myself.
Seeking something missing something left behind.
Maybe with good luck, we'll find what eluded us in the places we once called home.
And also one that I think says a lot about Wes, who started traveling abroad when he was promoting the Royal Tenenbaums and never entirely came back to America.
Wes is also known for his repertoire of actors. That troupe seems to grow with every movie he makes. Is this his biggest ensemble to date? And what new faces do you think will become regulars?
In terms of the sheer number of interesting faces on screen, if this is not the biggest one, it's certainly up there. And I think he continues to add people that he's seen in other things. That's how a new face usually shows up in a Wes Anderson film, is he goes to the theater and he sees an actor he likes, or he goes to the movies or he watches a TV show and he sees some actor he likes, and then he, you know, ends up working with them. Sometimes he writes something for them. Like Jeffrey Wright has become a pretty solid regular part of his ensemble now. And Wright is somebody that Wes saw on Broadway like 20 years ago and said, I want to work with that guy. But it wasn't until The French Dispatch that he sort of gave him a part that was really written for him.
Do students of the table dream in flavors?
That was the first of the questions a reporter for this magazine had diligently prepared in advance of his encounter with Lieutenant Nescafier, ranking chef at district headquarters on the narrow river peninsula known as the Rongier d'Angle. All such queries were to remain unanswered in the course of that eventful evening. Shall I carry on?
Like it was just based on his understanding of what Jeffrey Wright was an absolute master at, which was kind of narrating the world with that wonderful mellifluous voice that he has.
One of the most fascinating sections of your book is when you turn it over to Wes's longtime composer, Alexandre Desplat. His music ties the anthology together so beautifully, but each section is completely unique in terms of tone. What did you learn about Desplat's approach, and what can you share with us?
Well, one of the things that I really love about those two working together is that it really is a collaboration. And a lot of times, Wes will approach Alexandre and say, I have a scene where this happens. And the composer will immediately begin working on something and will send it to him, and kind of in a rough form. And the rough form might inspire Wes in the actual writing of the scene. And it'll continue that way all the way through production. And the score and the movie itself evolve organically more or less at the same time. That's not how things are usually done. Usually you make the film, you finish the film, you have a bunch of temporary music in there when you're editing, and then you strip it all out and somebody puts the original music in. And this really is more like a collaboration between a director and a writer, or a director and an actor, where it starts at the beginning and it continues all the way through.
Matt Soler-Seitz, thank you for joining us today. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on The French Dispatch. It's a beautiful looking and beautifully written book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Matt Soler-Seitz is the author of The French Dispatch. Find out more about Matt and Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch at wpr.org/beta.
She had tumultuous personal relationships outside of her marriages. I think the only place that she was in control was in the studio.
Coming up, writer Stacey Easton on the life and career of country music superstar Tammy Wynette. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.